طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We have been celebrating the way in which oppressed peoples are seeing the commonality of the struggles of others around the globe and are rising up in support of each other. Whether it is around the issue of incarceration, police abuse, blatant discrimination, or land confiscation, hands are being extended around the world to challenge all forms of oppression. A marvelous example of this, the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee, called the BNC, has written the following statement of support to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which is fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline being constructed by the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation. The largest coalition in Palestinian civil society that leads the global BDS movement sends a message of solidarity to the sovereign Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The people of Palestine support you and all those standing with you right now in North Dakota to protect your tribal lands and resist the desecration and destruction of your sacred burial sites at the hands of the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation and the Dakota Access Pipeline they are building. The BNC supports the restoration of all lands guaranteed by treaty to the Standing Rock Sioux and all other indigenous nations. As indigenous Palestinians, we pledge to stand in solidarity with indigenous peoples around the world, including in Turtle Island, in their struggles for justice, determination, restoration of rights, and respect for their heritage. Palestinians understand all too well how settler colonial authorities use resource extraction and other economic and bureaucratic pretenses as a way to solidify control over indigenous land and dispossess indigenous people. When we look at Standing Rock, we see our indigenous sisters and brothers defending their land, their identity, their dignity, and their heritage. Your response to the pipeline project defends not only the rights of all those who utilize the watershed of the Missouri River from potential environmental catastrophe, it ultimately defends all of us from continued fossil fuel extraction at a time when climate change threatens us all. When we look at Standing Rock, we also see the attempts of authorities with a still prevalent colonial mentality to vilify, criminalize, and ultimately disappear indigenous peoples on their own land. The Palestinian people have firsthand experience with the colonial power desecrating our burial sites, destroying our indigenous communities, and appropriating our culture and otherwise gradually erasing our centuries-old heritage. Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, with the help of the U.S.-based Simon Wiesenthal Center, has ruthlessly destroyed and desecrated large portions of the ancient Palestinian Mamilla Cemetery in Jerusalem to build the so-called Museum of Tolerance, without any sense of irony. Momilla is a Muslim burial ground and holy site believed to date back to the 7th century. Numerous Sufi saints and thousands of other Arab officials, scholars, notables, and Jerusalem Palestinian families, including companions of the Prophet Muhammad, have been buried in the cemetery over the last 1,000 years. Since 2010, the Center for Constitutional Rights in the United States and the Campaign to Preserve Momilla Cemetery, led by Palestinian figures with direct connections to some of those buried in Momilla, have worked to halt construction of the new facility and preserve what remains of the site. The BDS movement has learned much from and has been profoundly inspired by the history of resistance to other settler colonial projects, such as the more than 500 years of indigenous resistance to the genocidal European colonialism in the Western Hemisphere, including the United States. Your tribe and your many allies are part of a grand tradition of resilience and resistance in the face of dispossession of ancestral lands, cultural destruction, forced relocation and ethnic cleansing, brutal wars, and genocide. We owe the indigenous people of Turtle Island a great debt for lighting the way and showing what it means to resiliently resist colonialism generation after generation for more than half a millennium. The BNC was dismayed but not surprised to learn that the multinational security corporation G4S has been contracted to provide security services for the pipeline construction on your land by Energy Transfer Partners. G4S is involved in human rights abuses around the world, including in Palestine, where the company provides services to illegal Israeli colonies, to military checkpoints, and to prisons that are infamous for using torture and inhumane treatment against Palestinian prisoners, including children. We are particularly horrified to learn that on September 4th, defenders of your ancestral land were attacked with dogs and pepper spray, a chemical weapon used by a different private security company hired to protect pipeline construction. The BNC calls for intensifying worldwide boycott and divestment campaigns against G4S and all private security companies that violate our human rights and use weapons and violence against the indigenous people whose land they are operating on and against oppressed communities the world over. Once again, violence and brutality are being used to attempt to control the people standing up for their land, their culture, and the earth. Once again, the resistance will not be contained or curtailed by the violence and intimidation tactics of the oppressors. The BNC is committed to building stronger ties of solidarity between our peoples and movements, and we will work with our partners in North America to make this a reality. From Palestine to Standing Rock, we shall stand united against colonialism, corporate criminality, and for all our inalienable rights to freedom, justice, and equality. That was a statement of solidarity sent from the Palestinian BDS National Committee to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North America. And now on to our feature presentation this morning. It is a presentation given by Miko Peled. Miko was born in Jerusalem in 1961 into a well-known Zionist family. His grandfather was a Zionist leader and signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father, Mati Peled, was a young officer in the War of 1948 and a general in the War of 1967 when Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai. But Mikko has a different vision for Israel and for the Palestinian people, as you will hear. And now here is Mikko Pellett speaking at the Church Center for the United Nations in New York City.
I just got back about 2 weeks ago from Palestine. And I have to say, this particular visit was probably more difficult than most, because the reality, the pressure under which Palestinians live, and the blatant disregard on the part of Israel for Palestinian life and the reality in which Palestinians live is almost hard to describe in words. And now we have this book, and I see it as a great opportunity to do two things. First of all, tell the story, which people listen to, and that's a good thing. Many people say, well, if a Palestinian said this, nobody would be listening. So I'm glad to have that platform. And the other thing, which I think is really missing from the conversation here in this country, although it's improving, is context. We very rarely hear about this issue with context. So suddenly Palestinians are stabbing people. Suddenly there's rockets flying out of Gaza. Suddenly this happens. But there's never any context. And what the book allows me to do, and what I do in these in talks, is to put together the context and kind of a timeline, how it began, where we stand today, and how do we move forward. And I like to start with a couple of questions. So the first question is, are Palestine and Israel one country or two? Is the reality on the ground there one that is of war, or is it a struggle for freedom and justice? Is the way to achieve our goal, is it something we do through peace talks, or is what required resistance? I think these are really, really important questions to ask, especially like Helena was mentioning, we're right across the street from the United Nations, and now we've got the Palestinian flag that was raised there a few months ago. Because I think this is a big part of the context, this is a big part of moving forward and understanding where we stand. We hear people say, I visited Israel and I visited Palestine. And we hear people, or we hear countries that have been recognizing the state of Palestine. And so I always ask, well, where is this state of Palestine? I mean, the country is obviously the same country. It has two names. We have Israelis and Palestinians who live there, so two nations. But where is this state that people talk about? What are its boundaries? Who are its citizens? These are questions that are really important. And then, again, is what we're trying to achieve achievable through peace talks, or is it going to require resistance? And then what does resistance look like? And unless we touch on each and every one of these issues, I think we're never going to be able to move forward. Now, a requisite for, or prerequisite for understanding this is also, like I said, the context. And again, if we don't put it in some kind of historical context, then we're never going to be able to solve the problem. And I would say that it's fair to claim that the reason there's a problem in Palestine is because of racism and colonialism that came to Palestine from Europe. And when we look at the history of how things developed, then we have what everybody knows, I think most people are familiar with, is this thing called the Balfour Declaration, which in Israel is considered almost like one of the Ten Commandments. You think it came down the mountain with Moses. It was, every street, every city in Israel has a Balfour Street. So you think, well, who is this Balfour? Who is this saint or prophet? And what did he say? And what is this Balfour Declaration? And when we look right at it, it's basically Lord Balfour, who's the Foreign Secretary of Britain, promising a Jewish millionaire by the name of Rothschild Palestine for the Jewish people. And there were very few Jewish people in Palestine, and neither Rothschild nor Balfour had lived or had anything to do with Palestine. But this was the reality where white people could just take brown people's land and do what they wanted with it. And this is another example of that. And then the United Nations intervenes, and we have the partition plan. And unless we understand this partition plan, again, there's no way to understand how we got to where we are today and what came after that. And these are things that when we have the normal dialogue groups and the normal kind of conversations between Israelis and Palestinians, Israelis usually do not want to discuss. They do not want to discuss that part of the history. They always say we need to look forward, we need to move on beyond that. And I think we have to discuss it, so I'm going to discuss it. And if we look at the partition plan, you know, this is a map of the partition plan which the United Nations passed. I have to assume that whoever drew this map must have been on drugs or hungover or something, because it's an absurd map. And the boundaries are obviously, you know, completely unachievable. But besides that, as we can see, they divided the country into a large part and a small part, a bigger country and a smaller country. And there's this impression here in America, and I think generally around the world, the Jews have always lived there. You know, that has always been populated by Jews. That today, citizens of Israel, we are the descendants of the ancient Israelites, and we've always been there. And what people don't realize, when this plan was put together, there were less, or maybe just about 500,000 or half a million Jews living in Palestine. Most of them were, like my grandparents, Jews who came to colonize, who had arrived, you know, in the 40 or 50 years prior to that. And then the first generation Israelis, which were my parents' generation. That was it. Now, the vast majority of the population, at least three times as many, were the local Palestinians. And they were given the smaller portion. So the United Nations gave the larger portion of the land to a small community of immigrants or colonizers who just got off the boat, basically. And then, of course, the expectation that this was going to work is absurd. But what's even more important about this, or equally important, is how we interpret what happened next. And this is the pillar of the conflict. This is the main, these are the main pillars upon which this conflict rests. It's how we interpret what happened from that moment on. So the story that I was raised upon, and the story that we learn in America and basically the West has accepted, is the Zionist version, which says that this was a story of revival and heroism. After the United Nations passed the partition resolution, the Arabs attacked the Jewish community, wanting to kill them. And miraculously, because we're heroes, because we are the descendants of King David who defeated Goliath and so forth, we were able to defeat the Arabs once again, or, you know, some evil empire once again, and we prevailed, and now we have a state for the Jewish people in their historic homeland after 2,000 years. Again, it's like a chapter out of the Bible, like a chapter out of the Old Testament. It's so dramatic, and how do you even begin to argue with that? And then we have the Palestinian version, which talks about ethnic cleansing, terrorism, and a very cruel occupation. Now, go bridge those two stories. They're unbridgeable. And I think one of the realities we have to accept about this issue is that when you accept one narrative, you necessarily reject the other. They can't live together. And it's one of these issues, and I think the solution and the reality today is the same. You either, by accepting one narrative, you reject the other. There's no room here for them to live together. They are diametrically opposed. And this is something which is very difficult for some people to accept. They say about me in my talk that I'm divisive, and I'm saying it's not me that's divisive. The reality is such that if you take a stance, it's divisive, you know. But this is why it's divisive. We have two stories that emerged after this point at the end of 1947, 1948, that are diametrically opposed. And it really wasn't until Israeli historians began looking into this, like Ilan Pape and some of the others, and validating what the Palestinians have been saying, that people began to pay attention to the Palestinian narrative. Palestinians have been saying these things for decades, but we can't believe them. Ilan Pappas says it, you know, Jewish Israeli with German background, and now people are paying attention. So that's a sad reality of this. Now, I had another interesting experience, which was very personal, and I relate the story in my book, and that's a story that has to do with my mother. And my mother was born and raised in Jerusalem. She still lives there. She's going to be 90 this year. And a story that she told me many, many times as I was growing up has to do with an experience that she had in 1948. Now, living in Jerusalem as she was, as she did, and she still does, she was living in a small apartment with her parents. And when the Israeli forces came in and took the Palestinian neighborhoods of Jerusalem, I'm talking about West Jerusalem, which became part of Israel, these beautiful Palestinian homes became available and were offered to Israeli families. So my mother was offered one of these homes. And by the way, these neighborhoods and these homes are still there. They're occupied by Israelis. But my mother decided, she said no, she refused. She said, I'm not going to take the home of another family. How can I possibly move into the home of another mother? Now, at 22 and being already a mother, refusing a beautiful home for practically for free is not something that's easy to do. So we're all very proud and happy that she did that. And then when she told me the story, and again, she told me the story many, many times as I was growing up, she would continue the story by saying that after the Palestinians were forced out of their homes and these homes were taken, there was looting that was done by the Israeli soldiers. And she remembers seeing the trucks full of loot, full of furniture and rugs, and these well-to-do communities, well-to-do homes. And again, we're talking about the part of Jerusalem which became Israel, West Jerusalem. So it's a very interesting story, and it's a very good story. But for me, growing up, this story was a big problem. Because on the one hand, we had the narrative. And on the other hand, there's a very personal story of my mother. And the two contradict each other, you know. And I wasn't really able to understand why this story was a problem for me until I was working on the book, and I realized that there's a problem here because her personal story contradicts the national narrative. Now we go on and we hear that there actually wasn't really a Palestine. And if there was a Palestine, and if there were Palestinians, then there weren't that many of them, and the ones that were there were poor farmers or Bedouins, and you know there was nothing there. So I like to show these pictures from the city of Yaffa, which is a city, you know, an Arab city on the coast of the Mediterranean. And it was a city of about 120,000 people with a rich business life and a social life and a cultural life, and a very famous theater called the Jamal Basha Theater was there, and the biggest names in the Arab world would come to perform. And several newspapers were published in Yaffa. And it was a thriving Arab city. And you can see the beautiful boulevards. And then in a matter of 2 weeks, in 1948, this big, beautiful city was brought down to about 4,000 people. And these 4,000 people were concentrated in one neighborhood with barbed wires and Israeli guards surrounding them. Now, this is an important story for several reasons. First of all, there was a Palestine, and this is one example of one city. Besides that, it shows us that Palestine is not and cannot be limited to just the West Bank and Gaza. And number three, this explains the refugee problem. Because people talk about the Palestinian refugee problem, as though it just came out of thin air. It's just there, the refugee problem. How did that happen? And where did these refugees come from? So I think this is an important story to tell. And again, Yaffa is just one example. Now, between 1948 and 1949, 1967, this is what the map looked like. Now, depending on where you stand on this issue, if you're a Palestinian and you understand and you're familiar with the Palestinian narrative, this is occupied Palestine. If you're an Israeli, or if you view it in an Israeli from the Israeli perspective, then this is the state of Israel prior to 1967, and perhaps one day, through some kind of mythical peace agreement with a two-state solution, this is what it's going to look like. And people still have this map from time to time, although in Israel this map doesn't exist. You're not going to see this in Israel anywhere. Not in school books, not in weather maps, not in any official documents. This does not. You don't see this delineation. But I think unless we come to terms with the fact that the occupation did not begin in 1967, the occupation of Palestine began in 1948, and that this represents occupied Palestine, the first 20 years of the occupied Palestine, where the majority of the land was taken by Israel, and settlers and settlements were built there, and settlers lived there. And although Israelis who live in Tel Aviv and some of these other places don't like to call themselves settlers, that's exactly what we are. And the land was stolen and the water was stolen and so forth. Unless we understand this, it's very hard to move forward. And this is a point where I still see people, even Palestinians will say, yeah, you know, the occupied Palestinian territories, and they refer to the West Bank and Gaza. And my question is, well, where are the Palestinian territories that are not occupied? Can somebody show them to me? And of course, there is no such thing, all of Palestine. And then what happened in 1967, again, the story that we hear is that Israel was under an existential threat, had no choice but to start the war, and then took the land, and it was spoils of war, and then maybe one day we'll have peace based on this map. Now, this is a picture of my father, you know, the general's son. This is the general while he's still in office, while he's still in uniform. And he made a name for himself as being, you know, a fierce young officer in 1948 who, you know, fought and, you know, on the Israeli side, of course, and fought for the land and fought for the people, the Jewish people, and so on. And then in 1967, as part of the Israeli high command, who took the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and all the other territories that were taken in 1967. But he did something very interesting, because immediately after the war, he stood up while still in uniform and said, we now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem, and what we need to do is to allow the Palestinians to establish a state in those two areas, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Which, by the way, those two areas, how did they become? Who created the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? Israel did. The reason that there is a West Bank and the Gaza Strip is because in 1948, Israel decided to keep those two areas out of the state of Israel. So they were delineated and defined by Israel. So that's what my father said immediately after the war. Of course, as he was saying this, this was the fifth or sixth day of the war, it was a six-day war, Israeli bulldozers were already destroying Palestinian towns and building Israeli settlements for Jews only in the West Bank, like they do everywhere else. And then he continued, after he retired from the military, to pursue this, and that was his legacy. The second half of his life he dedicated to this idea of the two-state solution and Israeli-Palestinian peace. It's based on that, and that's really when the idea of the two-state solution was invented. That's, you know, him and several others, they were the first ones to talk about it. And at some point in the mid-70s, they were contacted, he and these other Israelis were contacted by members of the PLO who were interested in this. And in this picture, he's with Issam Sartawi, who was a Palestinian ambassador in Paris for many years. And the issue was to convince, particularly Yasser Arafat, but to convince basically the Palestinian leadership or the rest of the Palestinian leadership that they should recognize the state of Israel, drop the demand for the return of the refugees, drop the armed struggle, drop the resistance completely, and make peace with the state of Israel. And this was something that took many years. And Issam Sartawi was one of the Palestinians who led this within the PLO. What we know today, looking back, is eventually they did convince Yasser Arafat. Eventually he did accept the state of Israel and drop the resistance and the demand to free all of Palestine. And that led to the Oslo peace process. And again, looking back as we what we know today, it was a catastrophic decision. The recognition of the state of Israel, the willingness to engage in peace talks with Israel, and the whole idea of the two-state solution and moving forward with that idea was catastrophic for the Palestinians. It was a big mistake. And much of the reason that the reality in Palestine for Palestinians is so severe today has to do with giving up the struggle to really free Palestine and the recognition of the state of Israel. But there's this tendency that any willingness on the part of any Israeli or any Jew to make the smallest concession or recognize in the smallest way the Palestinian suffering already hails, people start hailing them as peace heroes, as men of peace or women of peace. And, you know, this becomes the story. This particular general or that particular general spoke about peace. But they never renounce what they've done. And this is true for my father. I think my father was very sincere in his desire to bring about peace, and he really thought, and some of the people around him really thought, that the two-state solution was the only solution that was that had some chance. But the reality is they never looked back and said this entire thing was a crime. The entire ethnic cleansing of Palestine was a crime. And we need to somehow atone for that. That really never is something that never took place. So in summing up, and I think this is very important, what happened in 1967? In 1967, the occupation of Palestine did not begin. In 1967, Israel completed the occupation of Palestine, and the generals that were my father's comrades in arms all congratulated themselves for completing the job. They called it finishing the job. The occupation that began in 1948 was completed in 1967. It was not the beginning of something, it was the completion of the process. Which is why they went right ahead and started building cities and towns for Jews only, like they did in other parts of the country. They didn't see that there was any difference between the West Bank, what they call Judea and Samaria. Nobody says West Bank in Israel. It's Judea and Samaria or the Galilee or any other place. The second thing that happened, or as a result of that, is the finalizing of the single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people, what they call the Jewish state. And I think this is another crucial element. There is no possibility of a two-state. There is no possibility of a partition. There is a single state over all of Palestine. Israel established a single state. It's a single state for Jewish people, or with exclusive rights for Jewish people. Now, the reason I take issue with the fact that they call it a Jewish state is because I don't know what's Jewish about it. The majority of the people who live there are not Jews. There's a Palestinian majority. Most Jewish people don't live there. Most Jewish people live in other places and have never even been there. There's nothing inherently Jewish about the state of Israel, other than they use it, you know, the Star of David. But the regime that was established, as soon as the state of Israel was created, it was a regime of apartheid. Of course, they don't call it apartheid. They call it something else. But it was a regime of apartheid. The very first laws that were passed by the Knesset were laws that clearly defined Israel as a racist apartheid state. I mean, the mere definition of it as a Jewish state, where everybody knows that this was taken from Arabs, and there was a big Arab, you know, Arab-Palestinian population still there, is already racist. But we go on to the laws that relate to the land ownership and laws that relate to citizenship and so on. We know that the Israeli Water Authority, which controls all the water, allocates only 3% of the water to the Palestinian population. So the majority of the population is allocated only 3% of the water. So, I mean, this is beyond clear that from the very beginning it was defined and planned as a state that was an apartheid state. But again, unless we understand this, it's impossible to move forward. There is no way to redo or undo what was done. And taking the West Bank and settling it with Jews and building there for Jews only, that was exactly why it was taken. It wasn't a mistake. Now, basically what they were hoping to do, and they're still hoping to do, this is a process that's still going on today, you know, some 7 decades after Israel was established and almost 50 years since they completed the occupation, is to completely erase Palestine off the map. And indeed, in Israel, there is no Palestine. The map is like this. It says Israel. They talk about the Israeli cities and towns, whether they're in the West Bank or the Galilee or anywhere else, like it's all part of the same thing. And indeed, I think it is. They've created a reality where that is the way it is. And then we have the Gaza Strip. And again, this reality that exists there, this catastrophe that it exists there, that thankfully Bernie Sanders finally admitted to and alluded to and or talked about very clearly in the last debate, it's almost talked about again. There's never any context. How did this happen? How has it happened that we had hundreds of thousands of refugees ending up there? The Gaza Strip, like the West Bank, was defined by Israel. Now, as a result of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, they had to have a place to house all these refugees. So a line was drawn around the city of Gaza, and that is where they were pushed into. And refugee camps were built all through what was called this thing called the Gaza Strip. And if we look, I mean, I won't read through all the stats. And again, Bernie Sanders alluded to some of them. You know, 90% of the water is not safe for drinking. You know, a large part of the population are children. The majority of the population are children, and so forth. Literacy rates are very, very high. And you look at the poverty rate and the unemployment, and you look at the literacy rates, and that doesn't make sense. Usually literacy rates means, you know, that there's plenty of jobs and people are working and there's, you know, prosperity. Here we have high literacy rates and this disastrous reality. But of course, it's imposed on them by Israel. And all of this is a result of the ethnic cleansing of 1948. If there was no ethnic cleansing of 1948, there would not have been refugees, there would not have been a Gaza Strip, there would not have been a Hamas, there would not have been any of this. But unless we connect the dots and go back to where this started, there's no context. We can never understand why we are where we are and how do we move ahead. And then we have the attacks on Gaza. Israel began attacking Gaza in the early 50s, pretty much as soon as the Gaza Strip was established. And these are pictures of Israeli commandos coming out of Gaza. Israel had several commando units And the picture over there on the end is Ariel Sharon, a young Ariel Sharon. You see the knife on his belt? And these are the Israeli commandos coming out of Gaza. This is in the early 50s, after punitive operations. And the way they described it, or the way they justified it, is that there were infiltrators coming in from Gaza. And who are these infiltrators? You know, of course, we imagine all kinds of bloodthirsty Arabs coming to slaughter Jews, but mostly these were people who came to go back to their homes, to try to bring food. From time to time, they did come and commit acts of armed resistance. And then Israeli commandos would go in there and commit terrible acts of, well, massacres, really. This went on through the 50s, and then the 60s, and then the 70s. The names of the people in Gaza that justify the attacks change. At first they were infiltrators, then they were Fedayeen, then they were just plain terrorists. Now they call them Hamas. The name of the devil there is changes and evolves, and of course the weapons evolve as well. This is what it looks like. These are the weapons Israel uses today. So whereas in the beginning they would kill a few dozens or maybe a few hundreds, today, the last attack in 2014, Israel murdered over 20 or close to 2,500 innocent civilians in broad daylight, you know. So the ability to kill has grown. The weapons are more sophisticated. But still, the question that nobody asks is, you know, why? Why is Israel attacking Gaza so consistently, so heavily, knowing full well that there hasn't ever been, and there isn't today, any threat to Israel from Gaza? There's never been a tank in Gaza. There's never been a regular army in Gaza. People in Gaza have never had even the remotest ability to threaten Israel in any way. So why are they attacking them like this? Why did they go in with these enormous punitive operations? And I think the reason is that the existence of this humanitarian catastrophe, where nearly 2 million people live really, literally, next door to Israeli citizen towns where people live like this. I mean, you wouldn't imagine an Israeli town where there's no clean water running in the tap, there's no electricity, there's no air conditioning when it's hot. I mean, that doesn't exist where there's not plenty of food and medicine when you need it. And this is across the street from this humanitarian catastrophe. Almost 2 million people living without water that's fit for drinking. Imagine a child that needs antibiotics, and there's no antibiotics. I mean, it's that simple. Never mind the bombing and the thousands and thousands of injured that have no access to proper health care. And again, 10-minute drive from Gaza, you've got perfectly good Israeli hospitals that could treat people. But, of course, Palestinians in Gaza don't have access to that. This reality, when it sits right next to the reality in Israel, is a threat to the legitimacy of Israel. It's a threat to the narrative that illustrates Israel as a David that's fighting a Goliath. And so there are only two options. One option is to allow the people of Gaza, the refugees, to go back to their homes, to end the siege, to release the prisoners, to rebuild. But Israel doesn't want to do that. Doing nothing is not an option because people are going to ask questions. Why aren't you doing something about this? So they attack them and kill them and blame them for being terrorists, which works. And if we look as the years went by, Israel feels perfectly free to go and kill pretty much as many people as it wants in Gaza, and this excuse that they're terrorists works. In 2014, the excuse was self-defense. And how do you have to be, it's like a magic trick, you have to be a magician to convince people that dropping millions of tons of bombs on innocent civilians is somehow self-defense. But here in America, everybody talks about it. Self-defense, self-defense, self-defense. Self-defense against what exactly? And it's this image that threatens the legitimacy of the Zionist project, of the entire state of Israel. And again, this is happening every single day as we sit here today. Now, the problem with this issue is that it's not only happening in Palestine, it's happening around the world, it's happening specifically here in the United States. And one example of the persecution of Palestinians and Muslims here in America is the prosecution of what's called the Hoyland Foundation, or the Hoyland Foundation case, which is also the subject of a book I'm working on right now. And The story of the Holy Land Foundation case was the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Muslim charity organization in America. After 9/11, by an executive order, George Bush closed them down, saying that they were funneling money to Hamas, supporting a terrorist organization. According to their lawyers, and I spoke to their lawyers, this is what they said. The entire judicial system here in America was taken hostage. The Constitution, the laws, and government agency regulations were suspended. And as a result of pressure by Israel, the post-9/11 hysteria, and cowardice of the judiciary, and I'm quoting this, okay, we have a bunch of guys who did nothing wrong and were given completely insane prison sentences. Now, the three that you see here on the screen are three that I was able to visit in prison. And there are two others that I have not yet been able to visit. But this points to the fact, a very strange reality, the existence of a very strange reality, where the persecution of a people in their own land was imported here to America. And this is the Holy Land Foundation case is a very big case, and it was really a foundation of this reality. But there are other cases as well, and this is a case that I'm working on, so I know quite a bit about it. But this reality that the persecution of a people continues after they left the country from which they are kicked out, and they're trying to build a life in a new country in the new world, and their existence. And again, because their existence here and their work here as a charity trying to help Palestinians contradicts the narrative. Contradicts the legitimacy of the state of Israel, they have to be persecuted and prosecuted if possible here in the United States. And the terrorism charges were complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. I saw the prosecution file, I read through the papers. It is complete and utter nonsense, and it's unbelievable the judges saw this stuff and allowed it to continue. And we have to talk about resistance. People don't like Hamas. Hamas is terrorism, so we don't like them because they're terrorists. And any form of, any expression of resistance by Palestinians is somehow equated with terrorism. The reality is, however, I think it was expressed best by Frantz Fanon, where he said, colonialism is not a machine capable of thinking. You cannot allow this colonialist project to go on and say, well, we're actually going to restrain it by allowing a two-state solution. You can't restrain it. The project of colonizing Palestine for the Jews meant colonizing all of Palestine for the Jews, and that's it. And you can't pull it back once you've set it in motion. It is naked violence and only gives in when confronted with greater violence. Now we know today, thankfully, because we had the experience of India, and because the Black American experience here, and the experience of South Africa, and today, specifically over the last couple of few decades, the Palestinian experience, we know that violence is not the only way. The armed struggle is not the only way to defeat colonialism and to defeat injustice. There are other ways. So there's economic pressure, there's political isolation, all of which worked in these other cases, not in Palestine yet, though. And there's the BDS, which now is being... Now there's legislation to outlaw BDS and even outlaw talking and suggesting boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So if a principled, unarmed form of resistance is illegal and armed resistance is illegal, what is exactly the expectation? That over 6 million people living in Palestine under Israeli occupation, granted the different parts of the country, they live under different laws and a different bureaucracy that governs their lives, and they're not allowed to do anything. They have to sit and negotiate, and they have to be good boys and girls. And if they dare talk about boycott, if they dare talk about isolating Israel or kicking Israel out of FIFA or pressuring artists and so forth not to go and perform in Israel, or if they dare, God forbid, to use armed resistance, all of it is bad. All of it is terrorism. All of it is, you try to legislate against all of it. It's not realistic. It's absurd. It is absolutely absurd to think that there will be no resistance. And here in the United States, there's another aspect which has really contributed to the conversation here, to raising the level of a conversation here in America, and that's Students for Justice in Palestine. They do tremendous work on campuses, unbelievable work, and the courage of these young people, many of whom are Jews, by the way. Some are Palestinians, but many of them are Jews, including, like you heard earlier, my son. You know, they have managed to fight, a very difficult fight against university administrations, against the millions and millions of dollars that are poured into this by Israel and Stand With Us and all these organizations. And this I see as definitely as part of the Palestinian resistance, and they're doing a very good job. So I think it's very important to recognize that this is what we need to support. You know, like I said earlier, do we use it peace talks or is it resistance? There's no question in my mind that as people who do care for peace and justice in Palestine need to support this resistance. The BDS movement, the Students for Justice in Palestine, and all other forms of Palestinian resistance, which are unarmed. Now, I was asked this earlier, and I get asked this all the time, is there any hope, or do I think there's any hope, or am I hopeful? And my question is this. There's no question in my mind that I am hopeful. I think we have to be hopeful. I think it's criminal to talk about this issue and not find hope. It's criminal because we're just sitting in the same place complaining all the time. It is up to us, who are rich, free, and alive, all at the same time, as they say, to find hope and then act. Now, where does hope lay? Where is there hope? Is there hope in a reality that exists today where there's a state, a single state in Palestine, that offers exclusive rights to Jewish people? Or are we going to find hope in a single democracy, in a democratic state that respects human rights, that allows for equality and justice and freedom for everybody who lives within its boundaries? This is the big question. And it has nothing to do with politics, it has everything to do with values. If we accept that having a state that only gives rights to part of the population, then that's one set of values. If we believe that all people deserve equality and justice and freedom, that's a different set of values, and there's really very little to argue. Because you can't argue, these are your values, you know. And of course, what I would support is the second option. And I'm going to leave you here with this image. This is a picture that I took in a refugee camp, Palestinian refugee camp. And let me tell you something, if any of us were living in that camp, none of us would be smiling. I can promise you that. A week in that camp, none of us would be smiling. And I think it's important for us to kind of wrap our heads around, what does it mean when we say free Palestine? What does free Palestine mean? And I would argue that a free Palestine means all of Palestine. Not a little percentage here and a little percentage there, a little piece of land here and a little piece of land there. All of Palestine, the Galilee, and the Negev Desert, and Jerusalem, and Jaffa, and the West Bank, and every other place, and of course, Gaza. Free from occupation, free from walls, free from racist laws. And if we're talking about hope, I would say that there's no question in my mind that Palestine must be free, and Palestine can be free, and if we do our job, then Palestine will be free, and much sooner than most people think. Thank you very much.
That was Miko Peled speaking at the Church Center for the United Nations in New York City. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.